Welcome to the Golden State Media Concepts Book Review Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah. And I mentioned in my very first episode how my mom used to send me outside in the summer to read because at least then I was getting outside, getting some sunshine and some fresh air. I always think about this in the summer when I'm wanting to do nothing but reading, and I have to occasionally also force myself to go outside. And since we're, you know, now in the middle of summer, I thought in this episode I would talk about some of my favorite so-called beach reads. You might have a different definition of what constitutes a beach read, but for me, it's something fun and light. It's not necessarily mindless or frivolous entertainment, although that can be fun too, but it's definitely reading that I do to escape. There's deep, heavy reading that is so good and impactful, and then there's also the reading that still might be meaningful, but isn't for me quite so heavy. And if I'm sitting on a beach somewhere, or, you know, I'm on vacation, or I haven't the opportunity to get some really good reading in, and my hubby isn't nagging me to get my nose out of a book, I'm going to want to read something that sucks me right in, that takes me on an adventure, and gives me a happy ending. For me, that is my definition of summer reading. Maybe I should call it escapist reading. Something that sucks me in, that takes me on an adventure, takes me into the lives of the characters, and gets me involved in their story arcs and their character development, and gives me a happy ending, gives me closure at the end. Humor is a plus. Romance can be nice. But these are the types of things that I think of when I think of summer reading. Maybe, again, I should call it escapist reading for my own personal point of reference. But that's what this episode is about. We're going to talk about my three choices for beach reads. We're going to take a quick break first, but when we come back, I'll be discussing three of my choices for summer beach reading. The Stephanie Plum series by Janet Ivanovich, The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan, and At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Want to find out what movies to go see? Then check out the GSMC Movie Podcast. It's your ticket to the latest movies, whether it's a new blockbuster event, romantic, comedy, or action flick. This show has got it all covered. They talk some what to go see now. Don't bother. What's hot on Netflix and everything in between? That's gsmcpodcast.com/movie-podcast. When it's all about the movies, it has to be this new show. Don't forget to like them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Visit gsmcpodcast.com for more info.
Welcome back to the Golden State Media Concepts Book Review Podcast. I'm going to jump right in with my first choice for summer beach reading, which, as I mentioned before the break, is the Stephanie Plum series by Janet Ivanovich. In the last episode, in episode 3, I spoke of another series by Ivanovich that she writes with author Lee Goldberg, and that's the Fox and O'Hare series, which is actually what got me thinking about summer and beach reading and got me thinking about this week's episode. I personally was introduced to the character of Stephanie Plum and the series that she is in during the summer of 2005 when I was doing an internship for grad school in Dallas, Texas. And the internship was really good. It was a great experience, but it was also a very stressful experience. And I definitely needed some good summer escapist reading. And a colleague of mine told me about the series, the Stephanie Plum series, and gave me the first book to read over a weekend. She said she loved them, and she had as many as were out then. She said she would loan them to me, so she loaned me the first one, and I devoured it. I read it so quickly that I actually had to go and buy the second one. I couldn't wait until Monday to ask if I could borrow the next one. I went out and bought. I think I might have bought the second and third one, just so I could read them without having to wait any longer. And I have been reading them ever since. There are currently 22 books in this series, with the 23rd coming out in November. So you have lots to read if you decide to jump into this series. It's not just a couple of books and you're done. If you love it, you've got lots and lots of story to go through. one of the really nice things about this series in terms of just logistics is that each book has the number in the title. So there's no guessing as to which book comes next. The first book is called One for the Money, and then Two for the Dough, Three to Get Deadly, etc. So as I said, if you're looking for the next one, you don't have to type in, do a Google search, whatever, which book comes next. You just look for the chronological numbers and go from there. So here's the overview of the Stephanie Plum series. Stephanie Plum is a bounty hunter with attitude. In Stephanie's opinion, toxic waste, rabid drivers, armed schizophrenics, and August heat, humidity, and hydrocarbons are all part of the great adventure of living in Jersey. She's a product of blue-collar Trenton, where houses are attached and narrow, cars are American, windows are clean, and dinner is served at 6. Out of work and out of money, with her Miata repossessed and her refrigerator empty, Stephanie blackmails her bail bondsman cousin Vinny into giving her a try as an apprehension agent. And that's only the beginning of the series that will set her on the trail of fugitives. Stephanie will have to sharpen her sleuthing skills because she's got many a mystery to solve. Yep. So Stephanie goes from working as a lingerie buyer in a department store to working as a bounty hunter. And the results are hilarious. So in this first book, she's trying to figure out what she's going to do for money because, you know, her rent is due and she needs food and her car has been repossessed, etc. And she's not having any luck in terms of finding a job. So she figures she'll just go talk to her cousin, Vinny, who has a bond agency, and see if she can get a job. And she does, like it said, she blackmails him into giving her that job. And she has no skills, no experience, and when she does get a gun, she keeps it in her cookie jar. So, as with the Fox and O'Hare series that I spoke about on the last episode, this one is made up with a huge cast of hilarious characters. I mean, Stephanie, as the main character, herself is hilarious. And the people that she's surrounded with are an absolute hoot. So you've got Stephanie, who has no experience, who doesn't like firing a weapon, who doesn't really know what she's doing, and yet she keeps stumbling into all of these mysteries, and she keeps, she actually does manage to apprehend the people that she goes after, but it's a comedy of errors. It's a bit like the Keystone Cops, except with bounty hunters. So Stephanie is hilarious, but then there are other characters, and with 22 books, you get a whole variety of them, but some of the ones that are in every story are her sidekick, Lula, who actually used to be a prostitute, but now also works at the bail bond agency. She's supposed to file, but mostly she goes and drives around with Stephanie, and they eat a lot of donuts and chicken. The books are actually worth reading just to find out what crazy outfit Lula is wearing this time. And her hair always coordinates with her outfits. Lula is short and round and in possession of, shall we say, very generous assets. Ivanovich always has a colorful way of describing her and her clothes and her body type. She likes to dress that body in clothes that are a couple of sizes too small, usually a crazy color, and almost always made of something stretchy. She did used to be, as she says, a hoe, pardon my French, and she still kind of tends to dress in that eye-catching manner. But you can't judge Lula by her wardrobe alone, though, because, yes, that's part of her character and that's part of her past, but she's also kind and hilarious, and she's a really staunch friend to Stephanie and her other friends. She's definitely good people, so you can't judge her by her past or her wardrobe. You have to judge her on her character merits, but she is hilarious. She always thinks she can do anything, whether she can or she can't. If you've ever watched Winnie the Pooh, and Tigger always says, that's what Tiggers do best. That's what Lula reminds me of. She can do anything, until, of course, she can't. Also hilarious, Stephanie's grandmother, who lives with Stephanie's parents, has absolutely no filter when it comes to speaking her mind, and does not keep her gun in a cookie jar. She prefers to keep it in her purse, thank you very much, even though her daughter does not approve. Stephanie's grandmother likes to attend funerals as social events, and along with Stephanie, causes her daughter, Stephanie's mother, to drink. Drink and iron, actually. That's what she does when she's stressed. Stephanie, Lula, and Grandma get themselves into plenty of situations that cause Mom to worry and drink and iron. And I know she's fictional, but I often wonder if maybe she'd be willing to come to my house and worry and iron. I mean, she could definitely come iron my clothes if she were real. So as I mentioned there, because there's 22 books, it's a large cast of recurring characters that each bring their own unique zaniness to these books. If you like to laugh, if you like ridiculous situations, then this is a book that is definite escapist summer beach reading. There's also hot men, not just one, but two, one of whom is Joe Morelli. He's the former bad boy turned cop who is Stephanie's on-again, off-again boyfriend. And despite his wild youth, he's turned into an adult. He's turned into a very good homicide cop. He's turned into an adult with a house and a dog. The fact that he's a very attractive Italian man doesn't hurt either, but he's definitely the more mature between Stephanie and himself. He may have been the bad boy in high school, but he's definitely matured more. And they have this very interesting relationship where they're trying to figure out, do they get married? Do they just date? What are they to each other, etc.? And in the meantime, there's Ranger. Ranger, who is tall, dark, and mysterious. He's Stephanie's mentor at the bail bonds office when she first starts working there. He's also an apprehension agent with actual experience, so he definitely helps Stephanie out in her learning curve, which is very steep. And I'm pretty much going to leave you with Ranger's air of mystery, because if I talk about him too much, I might drool on the microphone a little bit, and that would be bad. So moving on. It's a mystery series. So each book contains a mystery of some sort that Stephanie has to solve. Usually it's connected in some way to the people that she's tracking down as a bounty hunter, although not always, because Stephanie can really get herself into a crazy situation pretty much just by getting up in the morning. Chances are good something is going to blow up or burn down if Stephanie, Lula, and or Grandma are involved. So it's really no wonder that Stephanie's mom worries and drinks and irons. So if you're looking for a series that is funny and fun, then I can highly recommend these. In full honesty, I will tell you that the last couple I felt have gotten maybe a little stale, maybe a little formulaic. But with the 22 books that are already published and ones that are coming out, you're certainly going to have a lot of laughs and a lot of books to enjoy. So I still recommend them. And you may have a different opinion than I am. You'll only know if you read the books. But we do have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan. So stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Tired of searching the vast jungle of podcasts? Now listen close and hear this out. There's a podcast network that covers just about everything that you've been searching.
Hey!
The Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network is here. Nothing less than a podcast bliss with endless hours of podcast coverage. From news, sports, music, fashion, cooking, entertainment, fantasy, football, and so much more. So stop lurking around and go straight out to the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. Guaranteed to fill that podcast itch. Whatever it may be. Visit us at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And download us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play.
Welcome back to the Golden State Media Concepts Book Review Podcast. Before the break, I was talking about Janet Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum series. And now, as our second book in our summer beach escapist reading episode, I want to turn our attention to a book called The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan. Now, I personally came to know Heather and Jessica as the Fug Girls from their fashion blog, Go Fug Yourself. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but I personally know next to nothing about fashion, but they are such enjoyable writers that it really doesn't matter. I started reading their blog because it is well written and it makes me laugh. And, you know, I do like to look at fun clothes or zany clothes or crazy clothes or whatever they're talking about. So it's its own escape. It's its own form of escape. And then several years ago, they actually wrote their first book together, which was a young adult novel that was followed with a sequel. And I enjoyed both of those. So when they then wrote their first adult novel, I was really excited. And I wasn't disappointed when it came out and I read it. So here's the overview. American Bex Porter was never one for fairy tales. Her twin sister Lacey was always the romantic, the one who daydreamed of being a princess. But it's adventure-seeking Bex who goes to Oxford and meets dreamy Nick across the hall, and Bex who finds herself accidentally in love with the heir to the British throne. Nick is wonderful, but he comes with unimaginable baggage, a complicated family, hysterical tabloids tracking his every move, and a public that expected its future king to marry a Brit. On the eve of the most talked-about wedding of the century, Bex looks back on how much she's had to give up for true love and exactly whose heart she may yet have to break. I wasn't fully sure about this book at first because as much as I love Heather and Jessica's writing, this book is loosely based on the courtship of William and Kate, and I wasn't sure exactly what to expect. You know, I wasn't sure if it was going to be maybe a little cheesy or, you know, I don't know. I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I do love their writing and I do love their work, so I was up for the adventure. And it turns out that the book is utterly charming, and I really loved every minute of it. Making Bex, Becky, you know, she goes by Bex, making Bex American means that we can put ourselves into that role of growing up to be a princess. And while I personally would make an absolutely terrible princess, it's still fun to daydream about the what-ifs and to put ourselves into that role of, you know, what if I just happened to meet that person and we just happened to fall in love? What would that look like? And Heather and Jessica make the characters relatable and understandable, and they're able to show how, in this case, fictional, how the royal family is a family, so much like everyone else's, just, you know, with that insanely famous family tree and paparazzi who follow them everywhere and really large expectations placed upon each and every member of that family. But they also show that they are a family who quarrel and tease and have dysfunctions and arguments, and they're the same in a lot of ways as any other family, even if their issues might stem from completely different sources. Again, as I said, it's loosely based on William and Kate, but with enough differentiation that while it still feels a bit like reading fanfic, it's incredibly well-written and thought-out fanfic, if that makes any sense. The authors also do a really good job of showing just how much work goes into being a royal and how high the expectations are, just how much work it goes into, you know, having to be that person who's in the public eye all the time, and how you're perceived and how your reputation stands up, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm one of those people who, you know, personally enjoys seeing pictures of the royal family, and it's fun to sometimes imagine living that life. But the book does a really great job of showing it as a full-time job to be that visible and that much in the public eye, and what really goes into a lot of that background stuff that we don't ever see. And there's one scene that actually sticks in my head from this. I mean, there's all of the ones where, you know, they're trying to make Bex more presentable. So, you know, she's got to have different hairstyles and, you know, do her makeup differently and make certain wardrobe choices. But there's one that sticks in my head, and it's when one of Nick and Bex's friends teaches Bex how to properly exit a car so that there will be absolutely no chance of someone with a camera getting even the possibility of a shot up her skirt, which, you know, just sounds like something that most of us don't ever really have to think about this. Although now I actually do. I think about this scene as I'm getting out of the car in a skirt. Not that I make a habit to try to get out of the car in an unladylike manner, but I'm just grateful every time I do that I have no worries about someone with a camera trying to get a shot that they can put in a tabloid. I mean, these are things that they seem kind of silly and funny, but the book does a great job of showing just exactly what goes on behind the scenes, what happens in the lives of the royal family, or really anyone in the spotlight, and how you have to actually think about these things. And so because of all of this, Nick and Bex do not have an easy time taking their relationship from friendship, which it starts out as, to then secret dating, because they do discover that they're attracted to each other, and then public dating, and then to engagement and beyond. And you can imagine that Bex, being an American, adds an extra level of taking that relationship public, because, you know, this is the royal family, and it is a lot about family tree and pedigrees and those sorts of things. So it's really interesting that Bex is not only a commoner, but she is an American. So we get to see that. So there's drama and scandal and fights, and we get to see not only Nick and Bex interact and their relationship evolve, but the relationship with their siblings. So Rebecca has a twin sister, and they're is a lot that goes into that, as, you know, they try to navigate their relationship as sisters, but as Bex increasingly becomes more visible, more, shall we say, popular, and trying to figure out, you know, just how am I supposed to be the twin sister of someone who may someday be the Queen of England? This is not something I've ever had to even consider. So now Lacey, the twin, has to figure that out. And also the brother, Nick's brother, who's, again, loosely based on Prince Harry. And those relationships and, you know, just looking at different ways of the pressure of being in the public spotlight and how that affects family relationships, etc. So like I said, there's drama and scandals and fights, but there's also a lot of warmth and heart and really good character development. And there's that sweetness of their relationship. And again, the really great character development of showing how they came to be at these points in their lives, because the book opens up on the eve of their wedding, and then everything's kind of told in bits and pieces and backstory and how everything developed. And it shows how all the elements of those lives, as well as the people in them, have worked to shape what both they and their relationship have evolved into. This is a standalone book, so not part of a series, unless there's something that the authors aren't telling us, which would be awesome. I mean, hey, I'd be up for a sequel. Maybe, you know, we could work in some of those royal babies. But it is currently a standalone book, so this is the perfect summer read for a quick jaunt into someone else's world and life. It's got humor, romance, drama, and fabulous British words like snogging. So I have nothing but good things to say about this book, so I would just say go read it if you haven't already. We, in the meantime, have to take another quick break, but when we come back, I'll be moving on to my third choice for summer beach reading, which is At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Do you want to be healthier, yet you just don't know what to do? All these shows telling you this and that, but nothing seems to work. Well, listen close. Golden State Media Concepts has got something great for you. The health and wellness podcast dedicated to workout trends, healthy eating habits, diet, and everything about healthy living. Join us in our banters as we help you not just live life to the fullest, but live it to the healthiest.
Media Concepts Book Review Podcast. Before the break, we were talking about The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan, and now we're going to turn to my third choice for beach summer escapist reading, whatever you want to call it, and that is At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen. You might have heard of Sarah Gruen from her book Water for Elephants, which was made into a movie. And that book is also a good candidate for a beach summer type read. But today I want to look instead at one of her more recent books, At the Water's Edge. Despite the despite its title and the theme of this episode, The Water's Edge is not, in fact, on a fabulous beach somewhere, but rather on the shore of Loch Ness in Scotland. And not that I'm not saying that that couldn't be fabulous, but maybe it's not exactly the beach that comes to mind when you're thinking about beach reading. Anyway, the overview of this particular book is as follows. After disgracing themselves at a high society New Year's Eve party in Philadelphia in 1944, Madeline Hyde and her husband Ellis are cut off financially by his father, a former army colonel who is already ashamed of his son's inability to serve in the war. When Ellis and his best friend Hank decide that the only way to regain the colonel's favor is to succeed where the colonel very publicly failed, by hunting down the famous Loch Ness Monster, Maddie reluctantly follows them across the Atlantic, leaving her sheltered world behind. The trio find themselves in a remote village in the Scottish Highlands, where the locals have nothing but contempt for the privileged interlopers. Maddie is left on her own at the isolated inn, where food is rationed, fuel is scarce, and a knock from the postman can bring tragic news. Yet she finds herself falling in love with the stark beauty and subtle magic of the Scottish countryside. Gradually she comes to know the villagers, and the friendships she forms with two young women open her up to a larger world than she knew existed. Maddie begins to see that nothing is as it first appears. The values she holds dear prove unsustainable, and monsters lurk where they are least expected. As she embraces a fuller sense of who she might be, Maddie becomes aware not only of the dark forces around her, but of life's beauty and surprising possibilities. Now, this book isn't as light as my other two choices, but neither is it completely dark or depressing. It's more of a drama than a comedy or a lighthearted read, and yet I loved it and I was sucked in. It really does, you know, fit into my parameters for summer escapist reading. I was sucked in. I enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed the setting, etc. The three friends, Maddie, her husband Ellis, and his friend Hank, who make the trip to Scotland, have been sheltered in such a way that they really haven't been affected by the war that much. This is 1944, so the war has been going on for a while, and yet they haven't felt the effects of it, of course, because they're in Philadelphia. It hasn't hit them close to home. And so it hasn't had much of an effect on them, except to sometimes disrupt how and where they're social. There are issues of class, both from the American perspective, the Scottish perspective, as well as a combination of the two, when Maddie finds herself in uncertain territory, in a system that she doesn't fully understand, when she's suddenly confronted with extremely up-close and personal elements of the war that she never dreamed of. Because, you know, they do decide to go off on this rather crazy idea to go find the Loch Ness Monster to prove that to succeed where Ellis's father failed, to try to prove something to Ellis's father. But you can see how very rash and sort of immature this decision is, because, you know, you're in the middle of a war. German U-boats are all over the ocean, and they decide to just, hey, let's go to Europe. Let's just cross the ocean in the middle of a war and have this adventure. So, you know, they're very selfish in a lot of ways and a little shallow. And then they're confronted with this new reality when they get to Scotland. The war is definitely an element in this book, as we see a snapshot of World War II from a specific place and time, as well as from this then outside perspective of people, Maddie especially, who come in from the outside, who haven't had to deal with the repercussions of the war prior to this, and now suddenly they're faced with blackouts and fuel shortages and rationing and family and friends not coming home. You know, it says a knock at the door from the postman can bring terrible, horrible news. So they're confronted with something that they didn't expect. I'm not sure what they expected when they went into the middle of a war, but they're confronted with the realities that they weren't prepared for. And finally, there's also the somewhat, a little bit incongruous element of searching for the Loch Ness Monster in the middle of a war. But this is what drives Maddie and Ellis and Hank to Scotland in the first place, of course. And so they go looking for the Loch Ness Monster again to try to prove something to Ellis's father. And I did have a bit of difficulty during the first part of the book in liking the characters because they do come across as spoiled and vacuous, and Hank and Ellis really don't improve much. In fact, Ellis's character gets progressively worse throughout the book. But thankfully, the plot centers on Maddie, and part of what drives this book is her character development and how her relationships with those whom she meets in Scotland affect and change her. She really does go through this incredible character arc and character development throughout this book. And I recently read a review on this book that was extremely negative about Maddie's character and her character development. The negativity centered on Maddie and her developing friendship with a man named Angus, who is the owner of the inn where Maddie, Hank, and Ellis stay while they're in Scotland. As Maddie is left increasingly on her own by Hank and Ellis as they, you know, keep going off on this adventure to try to find the Loch Ness Monster, Maddie begins to form relationships with the staff of the inn, and her own worldview begins to shift. Rather than focusing on all of her relationships, both platonic and, you know, just everyone that she encounters, rather than focusing on those relationships and her growth, this reviewer was upset because she felt like the book turned away from the genres of historical fiction and the supernatural element presented with the storyline centering around the Loch Ness Monster, and instead the novel became a romance novel with a white knight element. And I can understand to a certain extent where this particular reviewer was coming from, but I don't agree with her assessment necessarily. I'm not going to give away the entire book or the ending, but I am going to cover a little more than I normally do in terms of plot with this next part, so if you don't want any spoilers at all, then you might want to stop listening to just this little part right here. Because the character of Maddie does go through a lot of change and growth in this book, and her relationships have a lot to do with that change and that growth, both negatively in terms of her relationships with Hank and Ellis and how those evolve, and also positively through Angus and also the other staff and the people that she encounters at the inn and in the village. For me, this growth was consistent with her character's storyline because she was a very privileged, very sheltered young woman who had an extremely difficult relationship with both of her parents, neither of whom provided her with any kind of a decent example as to how to be in relationship, either platonic or romantic. And Ellis is too similar to her, I think. He also has no good role models when it comes to relationships, so it's really no wonder that there isn't much growth for either of them in their marriage. I think they're too similar. Neither of them had good role models, so there's not a lot of room for growth from these people that they were together at the beginning of the book. And I feel like what the particular reviewer that I am referring to was hoping for was for Maddie's character to change so dramatically that she would become, you know, an independent woman at the end of the book with no need for a man of any kind, whether husband, father, lover, friend, etc. And I just don't see this as consistent with her character arc because I don't see it either as accurate for the time period. Were there women in the 40s who were independent and self-sufficient? Absolutely, of course there were. But that wasn't the model that Maddie had been given in her life. That wasn't how she was raised. That wasn't how she saw the world. And I don't think it would have been a logical direction for the plot line to take if she'd suddenly just, you know, thrown off everything from her past and become this completely different person. I also didn't feel like the relationship portion of the book took away from either the historical fiction or the supernatural elements. So, you know, if you read this, you might disagree. You may agree with that original reviewer. And that's cool, but you will have to read the book to find out and to see what you think about it. Again, I know I gave away a little bit more than I normally do, but I still hope you'll read the book because there is so much more depth of character and plot lines to be found than what I've just talked about. I mean, there's so many other things that are enjoyable and interesting and actually fascinating about this book. So if you're looking for a good summer book, maybe one that isn't quite as light as your typical so-called beach read, then I would definitely recommend At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen. And that is all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much for joining me in this discussion of the Stephanie Plum series by Janet Ivanovich, The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan, and At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen. Don't forget that you can learn more about the GSMC Podcast Network and all of our great podcasts at www.gsmcpodcast.com. You can also subscribe to this and all the other podcasts on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and many other podcast apps. And you can follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at GSMC_book review. We're on Tumblr, Instagram, Google Plus. We're all over. So I hope you will join me again next time. But in the meantime, go get lost in a good book.